I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Farai Chidea. She's a journalist, she's host of the podcast One with Farai, and she is co-author with Vivek Wadhwa of the book Innovating Women, The Changing Face of Technology. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So this book is an anthology of writings by women in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and in entrepreneurial careers. How did this book come to be?
Well, I had met Vivek Wadhwa, a longtime Silicon Valley participant and agitator, at a conference. So when I say agitator, I mean that he's talked about racial issues in Silicon Valley for a long time, and he wanted to also talk about gender. And he needed a co-author, and I thought, what an amazing opportunity, and it has been.
So Silicon Valley and computer science and the STEM departments in a lot of universities are not only pretty much male-dominated, but also often really, really biased against women. What is going on? I mean, these are supposed to be meritocracies.
Well, you know, there's so much evidence, and we put much of it in the book, but there's even more research, you know, coming out day by day, that Silicon Valley is not a meritocracy for women or for most people of color. There are some exceptions. But recently, the CEO of Microsoft basically said that women shouldn't ask for raises, they should just go on a good karma system. And the amount of laughter, derisive laughter, that accompanied that remark was really extraordinary. And so, and later, you know, there was backpedaling, like, oh, I didn't mean don't ask for a raise. But there's this idea that women are supposed to somehow be saintly creatures who don't ask for anything, but yet the culture of Silicon Valley and the culture of technology is hard charging, iterate, iterate, iterate. And so gender stereotypes, women who are hard charging are called pushy and bossy and all sorts of other nasty things. And the women who may just be interested in STEM fields and want to quietly do their work are viewed as not being aggressive enough. So there's this real squeeze play that's affecting women in the Valley and elsewhere globally.
So that's basically there's no room for you at all. Either you're supposed to be aggressive, in which case you're called pushy, or you're not supposed to be aggressive, in which case you're called insufficiently aggressive.
Exactly.
So when women are young, when they're in their schooling, either elementary, high school, college, there's a lot of ways, subtle and overt, that they're steered away from STEM studies and STEM careers. What does that look like?
Well, one of the most fascinating stories was that I interviewed the CTO, Chief Technology Officer of Xerox, Sophie Vandenbroek, and she was widowed at a young age when she already had children. You know, her husband died of a heart attack while they were on a camping trip. And so her teen daughter, and this was a couple years ago, was getting her next year's class schedule. And as one might expect, I mean, it's not 100% correlation, but, you know, the daughter of a chief technology officer is going to be doing pretty well in math and science. But she was tracked into lower math and science classes than boys who weren't performing as well. And when Ms. Vandenbroek talked to her daughter, she found out that her friends, these other teenage girls who were doing well in math and science, were also being tracked into lower classes. So she went to the school and had a very pointed meeting. And so it's just one of these things where if you, and also another woman we spoke with, who is the head of Black Girls Code, had an experience where she sent her daughter to a fancy computer coding summer camp when she was 11, and her daughter came back and said, you know, Mommy, I really loved the classes, but the boys got more attention than the girls. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the potential of girls being under-recognized. And, you know, when a teenage girl can win the Nobel Prize, as we just saw with Malala Yousafzai, we can see that girls have infinite potential, and yet in science and technology, and then broadly, that's not always the case when people look at teen girls or young women or older women.
And we're not talking about, like, 1965. We're talking about now. I mean, girls are still being differently treated and differently tracked today.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, the examples, the two examples I just gave you of Sophie Vandenbroek and of Kimberly Bryant of Black Girls Code, these both happened within the past 5 years. And what Kimberly Bryant of Black Girls Code says is, and this is very much true based on statistical research, is that computer science programs actually graduated more people when she was in college, which was 20-plus years ago, than they are now, but a lower percentage of women as a total.
The examples you gave are daughters of women who are very strong in their fields. One can only imagine that it's a lot worse and a lot harder for daughters of, you know, very talented daughters, let's say, of single mothers who are just getting by, who aren't in STEM fields and things like that, because they don't even have an advocate.
Yes, well, you know, there are advocates who are being developed. So, for example, Black Girls Code works in urban areas. Whether or not they're low income, they're ones where often the parents don't have any particular technology experience, or they find themselves flummoxed when their kids are trying to do robotics. Like, my gosh, you know, my kid's trying to do robotics. How am I supposed to help? And so it becomes this wonderful virtuous circle where these programs, and there are many of them that are now reaching out to girls in STEM, are not only helping the girls, but also helping women understand the power of technology and that it's not a scary thing. And that, frankly, this is very critical to our time. Technology is everywhere. You and I right now are using technology to record this audio. The fluency with technology is steeped in people who are doing blue-collar jobs as well as white-collar jobs. So technology is not just for Zuckerberg. It's really for everybody.
Yeah, very much so. And one of the things that I was thinking about, I mean, the title Innovating Women, innovation is so much about coming up with new ideas to address problems. But the thing is, who gets to define what the problems are that we're putting our energy into solving? And I wondered if you saw women asking different questions or addressing different problems than have been traditionally out there in the, you know, in the entrepreneurial world.
Yeah, we saw that there was a trend that a lot of men were looking to create the killer app, and a lot of women were seeking to solve existing social problems. You know, like, we have a problem with healthcare delivery, and therefore I'm going to work on something that relates to this tangible problem. And there's nothing wrong with working on the killer app. You know, Twitter, for example, it was just an idea. It wasn't like, oh, the world needs Twitter. People invented it and then found uses for it. But I think that, you know, there is some evidence that women both are creating technology. So one of the people who worked on Waze, with W-A-Z-E, which is a traffic monitoring firm that was later acquired, is a woman. And so that's very practical. How do you get from point A to point B without getting stuck in a traffic jam? And then you also see people starting nonprofits like Black Girls Code, and you see people starting companies that use technology as a platform to deliver non-technological services. So care.com, which places caregivers in homes, is a technological platform so that if you are doing elder care, illness care, et cetera, you can use this platform to find a caregiver. So these are a lot of the things, and the founder of care.com is a woman. So these are all things that we see.
We're talking to Farai Chidea about her book, Innovating Women. So you've got, on the one hand, women who make it into these fields and are doing things like care.com and who have what we might call a natural compassion or interest in social issues and things like that. And then you have this kind of like warrior cutthroat aspect that exists in business culture, especially at the highest levels where there's the most money and power involved. Are women changing that culture in any significant way?
Well, there's an amazing set of women who are creating, like Loretta McCarthy, who is a financier who helped create Golden Seeds, which takes groups of men and women with wealth and applies that wealth to female-led startups. There's Kay Koplovitz also runs a different organization that does the same thing, and she's someone who made her money as a technological innovator in the world of early cable TV. So, you know, there are women. What we're seeing is this real amazing sense that women can create opportunities for other women, particularly the women who have become financially successful already. Many of them have devoted their time to creating organizations that reward companies for having female founders or co-founders. And the reason that that's important is because there's evidence that companies with female co-founders actually have a greater chance of long-term success than ones with only male co-founders, and also that companies that have a gender-integrated board with women as a part of it have 35% higher returns than companies that only have a male board. So these are hard facts, and when you think about business and fiduciary responsibility, it is the fiduciary responsibility of companies to deliver value to their shareholders. And so if you look at it not as a, the ladies, let's help the ladies, but let's help ourselves. I mean, I love the idea of helping women for women's sake, but that's not going to fly in terms of convincing a large group of the world of business that this is what they need to do. What's going to fly is what we are doing, Vivek and I are doing in this book, and what so many people like Kay Koplovitz and Loretta McCarthy are doing, which is making the business case for gender inclusion and gender integration. We have to make that case, and the numbers are there.
I think it's really interesting that we have a culture in which men, and let's call it what it is, which is essentially white men, act against their own interest. Their cultural interest in keeping a kind of boys' club is stronger than their financial interest in having stronger companies, because as you just said, a company gets stronger when it's integrated.
No, there's many different ways of thinking of interest. I mean, there's clearly ways in which these companies are working against a larger shareholder interest, but also people feel there's a self-interest that is also about feeling comfortable and feeling in control. And not surprisingly, a lot of people who start companies are control freaks, and that's not about the technology industry, it's just in general. And so when you think about control, you also think about who's with me. And if you have someone who is not necessarily, Rosabeth Moss Cantor of Harvard Business School talks about social replication, which is like people hiring people they feel comfortable around or people who are, quote, like them. That could be race, it could be class, it could be interest. And so there's this other form of self-interest, which is I just want to feel comfortable. I don't want anyone to call me out if there's a gender issue. I just want to do my thing, and I don't want anybody to give me any back talk, you know. So that's a different kind of self-interest, which may undercut the financial self-interest. And I think making people realize that their unwillingness to be challenged and their unwillingness to be gently pushed into the future is actually hurting their bottom line, that may help change things.
Very interesting. Now, there's a lot of sexual harassment in the workplace, including in the STEM fields, even when these women who are being harassed are highly trained professionals and equals of the people who are harassed, of the men who are harassing them. And then women have to make choices about what to do, to stay quiet, to fight, to leave. You talk about some of the women who write in this book talk about some of those choices. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we found a lot of women just left. And you know, incidentally, I'm working on a different book right now on more broadly on the future of jobs in America. And my original survey research for that book seems to indicate that the majority of people who experience discrimination, and I didn't limit it to gender, don't report it, and those who report it also mainly don't get a satisfactory outcome. And there are many reasons for that. I mean, there are differences of opinion about what constitutes harassment. There's some incidents of very, very clear harassment, but there's also ones that are more ambiguous. But what we found particularly in this book, one woman talks about, this is not sexual harassment, but it's certainly sexual discrimination, talks about being told that she was working, quote, mommy hours, because she wanted to work a slightly different schedule as a computer coder than other people. And a lot of the gender issues we saw right now, we're seeing some horrible things coming out in terms of harassment of women in the video gaming industry that really are more sexual harassment directly. But the whole mommy syndrome, the idea that women who choose to have families cannot also work, is something that we heard over and over again in Innovating Women.
It's interesting. I read a book once by a sociologist who was talking about the workplace in different countries, and it's not just that women are demanding better lives, but I mean more rational lives, that like work-life balance. But for example, in Europe, I mean, nobody's expected, very few people are expected to work 80 hours a week as a matter of course. And there was a great story about an American manager who was running a company in Holland and asked his employees to come in on the weekend to get some order out. And they just said, no. Are you kidding? Are you insane? And they got the order out on Monday. And so there's this sort of like crazy workaholism is not only gender discriminatory, it isn't even necessary.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that brings up some very deep cultural issues with the United States. You know, the United States, we are now officially the world's biggest workaholics. Of every developed country, we are the ones who spend the most time working per week and also literally leave 5+ million days of accrued vacation leave on the table every year. Don't take leave that's expiring. That says a lot, I think, about a level of both compulsion and fear within American society about what constitutes productive work. And yet there's many different studies that show that overwork does not produce productivity. There's a certain point at which your brain hits a wall. And, you know, for me, for example, I'm working on another book. Last night I was staying awake, trying to push myself, and I got so much less productive over time. I mean, I'm not saying that sometimes you don't have to just push through it, but on a macro level, companies also have to realize that there are kind of two separate issues. One is that overwork is generally valued in American society, but it is not shown to have productivity gains. The second part is that some occupations do actually favor people who have non-traditional sleep and creativity cycles, and computer coding is one of them. So there are famous stories about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, you know, coding for 30 hours at a time. That is something, there is a kind of, you know, and some writers do this as well, but there are times where certain people tunnel, but also then consequently they usually crash. So you can't expect the same person who's been coding for 30 hours to then come in at, you know, 9 a.m. the next morning after, you know, a coding marathon. So if you're going to have people who are pushing themselves to these extremes, you also have to have flexibility in the workforce. And that's a real negotiation that employees and employers have to work out.
We're talking to Farai Chidea about her book, Innovating Women, The Changing Face of Technology. Now, to what extent do women help other women in business, in STEM fields, in Silicon Valley, and not?
Well, you know, I think that it's a mixed bag like everything else. Some women, and I've mentioned the women who are doing the angel funding for female companies, but then also there's people like Sophie Vanderbrook at Xerox. You know, she mentors a lot of younger women in technology. There are a ton of women who are really, really, really delivering value. But sometimes, and I've found this myself in journalism sometimes, women in technology who have more power and who may have, you know, quote, come up in an earlier era say, well, I put up with this, why can't you? And there's some resistance to changing what are abusive paradigms. We see this in medicine, too, where there's been a lot of debate over how much time residents should work. And some of the people who survived earlier medical residencies say, I stayed awake for 36 hours, why shouldn't you? Well, patients end up dying sometimes if you've got residents who are half asleep. So there can be, as with many different changing fields, a resistance, this idea that just because I put up with it, you have to too. And I think, again, it comes to returning to analyses about what is actually working, as opposed to thinking that just because you survived something harsh, it made you a better person. You may have survived it, but it may not necessarily have made you better. But I think, by and large, women are learning to advocate for other women. It's not necessarily what we are trained to do as a society, meaning that if you are used to living in a society like America, like many societies, where men hold the most power, even as a woman, you may subconsciously privilege male decision-making because you see that as the norm. It's not even necessarily about, liking or valuing men more than women, but seeing male decision-making patterns as the norm. And so we're not immune to that as women.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of depressing day when you realize, but it happens, that women can treat you with more discrimination than men, for example, in your own workplace.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, I think there's examples both ways, and I would like to think that we are winning the question of how we can be more kind to other women, but it's an evolution, just like it's an evolution for men. Gender equality is an evolutionary process, and it requires work.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of your own experiences with dealing with these issues. I mean, you're not in high tech exactly, but did you identify with many of the women who wrote pieces in the book?
Oh, of course. And I have worked in the technology industry twice in very small ways, working on the content side. So I worked briefly at Etsy on the content and content community and social media side of Etsy, which has a ton of programmers. It's a marketplace, of course, but it's a very programmer-driven company. And I also worked earlier for One Economy, which is a digital broadband-oriented nonprofit. And before that, well before that, in 1995, I started my own website. And so I have been involved in technology in many different ways at many different times. What I have found in my own career is pretty much what we've been talking about. Some of my best bosses have been women, and some of my worst bosses have been women. I don't want to paint it with any one brush, but again, it's about evolving our way towards a situation where we can have women leadership that really value gender equality and male leadership that values gender equality. So I'm not going to say that my best bosses were men or my, best bosses were women. What I will say is that it's very much a mixed bag, and it's a choice. You know, the people who choose to act with respect towards people who they employ, regardless of race, regardless of class, regardless of skin color and ethnicity, it's a choice. And it's up to a company to reward the managers who make the best choices, not just to reward managers who hire through the old boys network. Diversity is increasingly important. Like, it's not even a question. If you look at a lot of the companies that are focusing on millennials, whether it's media companies like Fusion or whether it is entertainment companies, they get it. Their bottom line is that younger people are much more diverse in every way than older generations, and therefore they need to represent some face of the future. But technology is a very specialized arena, and journalism, of course, is a specialized arena. And in journalism, we've seen reverses in diversity, which really bothers me to no end.
Meaning we got to a certain point and are now moving backwards?
Over the past decade, particularly in print, but also in radio, we have seen less racial diversity, and we have not seen a lot of progress in gender diversity.
One of the pieces in the book, Innovating Women, that I really liked was written by an African-American woman from Alabama. And when she was young, she was continually overcoming racial discrimination. And for her, that meant studying harder and being the best. And she has these sort of beautiful examples of you know, having her code be the only one that worked in her class. And then she was a high achiever. And then when she got to Silicon Valley, she encountered overt and rampant sexism, which for her hurt even more. What's the dynamic there?
Well, you know, Silicon Valley, I mean, there's so many different directions I could take this, but part of it is that Silicon Valley is a place where people have traditionally been lauded regardless of their people skills. So, for example, Steve Jobs, who was unquestionably an amazing innovator, was not necessarily great with people. And there has been kind of a pass given. And there's also this idea of the tech bro culture, which is something we're seeing in the current debate over video gaming. We are seeing right now women who are speaking out against sexism in the video game industry literally receiving death threats. So there's this idea.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I mean, there's a woman whose name I'll recall in a second, who has been speaking out against, and she herself is in the video gaming industry, and she's been speaking out against the way that some of the video games are misogynistic. And so, for example, it's called Gamergate, if anyone is interested in looking more at this. But there is a game developer named Brianna Wu and her husband Frank, and they had to literally leave their home after receiving rape and death threats with their home address posted. And so they basically have been speaking out against some of the issues about harassing female developers. And there's something called doxing, which means using technology to get people's home addresses, financial information, et cetera. And what happens sometimes with when these gender issues escalate is that hackers will dox a person who is speaking out and post their home address on the internet and say, do what you want. And in some cases, what that means is rape and death threats and people having to run for their lives. I mean, this is really crazy.
I mean, in defense of what? Like, sexism is so important to us that we're going to kill people?
I guess so. I mean, I can't say why people do this. I can only say that there's, I mean, it's a much longer conversation, that there are forums like 4chan, which is an online forum, where basically any kind of threat to the autonomy of certain people in the tech community or the hacker community is taken as a call to action. So I can't get inside the mind of the people who are doing this, but there was also another incident against a woman named Anita Sarkeesian. She was going to Utah State University to speak about so-called Gamergate, and then she had to cancel the appearance because she got death threats, and because Utah is a concealed weapons state, they could not legally search the people going in to the venue to see if they had weapons, and so she canceled. This is real. This is all going on right now.
It's interesting because what we're talking about is such a reflection of all the other issues in our society that have to do with violence, that have to do with long histories of every different kind of discrimination, which has to do with our militarism, and all of these things get bound up together in what should be a kind of like safe place to be, which is women programmers, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would hate to see women's reaction to some of these things be, let's just create our own spaces. We need gender integration as well as, you know, I mean, they're male-only firms, so I'm not against there being women-only firms, but I'm very much focused, and I think Innovating Women is very much focused on integrating women fully into the tech and STEM economies.
So part of what's needed to facilitate that integration is, I mean, changes in education and so on, and part of it is a kind of bigger set of cultural changes. Like, what kind of changes would you envision?
Well, I think a large number of the questions have to do with the choices women are allowed to make. So do we, not on a corporate level, but on a federal level, have maternity leave policies? No, we don't. Afghanistan has a maternity leave policy. I'm not saying they're enforcing it, but they have one on a national level. America does not. It's shocking. You know, virtually every European country and many developing countries have maternity leave, federally mandated maternity leave policies. So first of all, you're now seeing this new development with companies, tech companies offering egg freezing to female coders. So that says, okay, we know that we're working you so hard that you can't really have children the typical biological way because we need you to work really, really hard through your fertility years, but we'll offer you egg freezing. One of the people I interviewed for my podcast, One with Farai, is someone who wrote a book called The Big Lie, which talks about how egg freezing technology, for example, is not nearly as secure as people think. So let's say that you're even 25 years old and you freeze your eggs. There's no guarantee that those eggs will survive the egg freezing process. And for tech companies to, instead of focusing on, we will reintegrate you into the workforce once you have had a child, say, just freeze your eggs, is a really interesting interpretation of the evolution of gender equality. I'm not sure that it's taking us in the right place. So what I think we need are federal level policies, companies that really recognize that, you know, what, and I'm not saying all women want a parent, but that those women who do want a parent should have the opportunity to do so, but also that men and women may work differently, but not less efficiently. So if you have some men who want to spend 30-hour coding marathons and then take a couple days out of the office, and some women who would rather come in, you know, not necessarily 9 to 5, but 9 to 7 every single day, that Kimberly Bryant, again, of Black Girls Code, talks about how she consistently exceeded her company's goals for her work as an engineer back when she was working in the private sector. And people didn't believe she could do it. But she did not win by doing things like other people. She won by motivating her team and working in a structured way. So you've got to recognize that not everyone's going to work the same way. And then it really does take this focus on corporate responsibility, individual responsibility, and even federal responsibility.
Farai Chidea is co-author with Vivek Wadhwa of the book Innovating Women, The Changing Face of Technology. She's a journalist. She's host of the podcast One with Farai, and I'll link to that on my podcast, SantaFeRadioCafe.org. Farai, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This has been great.